The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
As a journalist, you cannot get the gist right. I have to get it all right. I have to get every single syllable correct. And in this case, I did not. That I wrote that it was an explicit instruction, when in fact, the evidence now shows us that it was not explicit.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, April 30th, 2019. On January 17th of this year, BuzzFeed News reported a blockbuster. The headline reads, President Trump directed his attorney, Michael Cohen, to lie to Congress about the Moscow Tower project. It was a remarkable story, and within 24 hours of its publication, the special counsel's office had issued an unprecedented statement taking issue with it and describing unspecified components of it as, quote, inaccurate, unquote. It wasn't clear at the time what parts of the story were inaccurate and how much of it was true, but in light of the actual Mueller report, we can now identify the parts of the story that had problems and the parts that did not. The two reporters who wrote the story, Anthony Cormier and Jason Leopold, joined me yesterday to do a kind of after-action report on the story. How did they come to report what they report? What parts of the story do they stand by? What parts do they think they messed up on? How was the story sourced? And what does the discrepancy between the story and the Mueller report tell us about the conduct of Donald Trump? It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 413, a BuzzFeed After Action report with Leopold and Cormier. All right, before we talk about and do the kind of after-action report on your guys' story about Trump directing Michael Cohen to lie to Congress, I want to start actually much earlier, which is with some of the other stories that you guys have reported on the Trump-Russia stuff, because I think people tend to look at this story in a kind of vacuum, and I want to situate it in the context of a much broader range of reporting that you guys did. So whichever of you wants to take this, let's start with a kind of overview of the work that you had done prior to January 17th, 2019.
So, we've started covering the Trump administration really from our first days at BuzzFeed News. We both started. I started in early January, Jason shortly after that, and our editor asked us pretty simply to figure out what happened in 2016. Who were these characters involved? What were their potential roles in 2016? What were they doing before that? I started personally to look at Michael Cohen, some of his own dubious business dealings before he actually reached the Trump Organization. Our job was never to really examine the dossier, but we knew that Cohen, in this case, was a big sort of part of that, knew that he must have played some kind of role in 2016 and began to look at what he had done. We were very fortunate to work with some pretty incredible sources who gave us insight into not just Mr. Cohen, but eventually a number of entities that surrounded Trump and his campaign. In particular, we were able to glean insight into their finances. What money moved in, what money moved out, were these, you know, triggers, or were these things involved in the election, or were they simply just suspicious activity in their financial conduct? And then we pivoted over to, you know, we were looking at the money, following the money as a pretty, you know, tried and true investigative technique. And we figured, gosh, there's this deal in Moscow, potential deal, while he was running for office. We should figure out, you know, what happened there. We should get to the bottom of it. And we learned that the media essentially reported that, you know, that this business deal to build this gleaming tower in Moscow, this ended in January 2016. This was the line. And the Washington Post reported it, Times, others. It's been what, you know, Cohen had said publicly. It's what the president had said publicly. And we were able to learn that, in fact, that was not true, that this deal continued for many, many months after that. And they were much closer to, you know, actually signing on the dotted line and getting the thing built than anyone had truly known. So we became known for our ability to follow the money and to pinpoint areas of Mr. Trump and his associates' business practices that they had publicly lied about. And that was really the work that sort of thrust us onto the scene.
So, Jason, I want to pinpoint a couple of aspects of this reporting that, you know, have a important salience, at least to me. One is that shortly before the first Manafort indictment came down, you guys identified a series of wire transfers that he had allegedly engaged in that then became central to that indictment. Talk to me, without revealing any sources, of course, about how you guys got that story.
Sure. And that was actually a story that we published on the eve of the announcement by the special counsel that Manafort had in fact been indicted. You know, as Anthony noted, we spent much of the year following the money, and what we learned from our sources in 2017, and this actually predates Mueller's appointment, because at this time, when Anthony and I were still looking, were starting to look into this, what we learned is that this was part of an FBI investigation, and it had been an ongoing FBI investigation. But what we learned is that the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, the IRS and the FBI and some various law enforcement, federal law enforcement agencies had actually been looking into Manafort and his what they refer to as suspicious financial dealings and transactions, allegations of money laundering. They'd been looking into that back in 2013 and 2014 under Obama's tenure in office. And so we found that, you know, this sort of activity that was suddenly under scrutiny again actually, you know, dated back to, you know, years earlier. And what happened was, from some of the sources that we spoke with, is that it was more or less kind of just swept under the rug, so to speak, because the priority was not actually to rein in Manafort, but it was actually to get Yanukovych's, the money that he had taken. So the investigators, the federal, you know, FBI and other investigators who were looking into Manafort, they were more or less told that their, you know, the priority had shifted. And so in some cases, it left some people, you know, who are on this feeling somewhat frustrated, and, you know, they just kind of put this into a file, and it did not resurface, obviously, until the investigation by the FBI into, you know, the Trump campaign and any connection or role that Russia played, you know, in the election and the Trump campaign's connection to it. It wasn't until then that it resurfaced. And Robert Mueller gets appointed in special counsel in May 2017. And just a few months later, 4 months later, Manafort's indicted, and he had reached, you know, we found out that his office had reached out to the FBI and said, can we get that file that you prepared years earlier on Manafort? So this had been sitting there, and we found this, you know, Anthony and I found this to be fascinating, a fascinating part of what was happening, just as it related to financial crimes. So, you know, we did that story and then followed it up with another story on Manafort.
Okay, so I want to pinpoint something latent in what you just said, which is you're describing internal deliberations between the FBI and what becomes Mueller's shop here, and you had these wire transfers before the indictment came mm-hmm. up. Is it fair to say that you guys were speaking to law enforcement sources without talking about who they were or anything like that, that the rest of the press did not have access to?
I mean, I would say that, you know, as we identified in our stories, we had been speaking to law enforcement sources, and that's certainly how we sourced it. I would say that it seems pretty clear to it became apparent to us later on, Anthony and I, that much later on, that the individuals we were speaking with were not speaking with anyone else.
Okay. Anthony, another story I want to focus on here. You guys did an amazing kind of deep dive into who Felix Sater is. Felix Sater, listeners will recall, is a key figure in the Trump Tower Moscow discussions. He plays something of a role in the Mueller report on that point. You guys did a very long profile of him and focused chiefly on his prior law enforcement cooperation. What was the genesis of and the importance of that story from your guys' point of view?
So I think that Felix Sater, we had known of him, as had many people who had been following the Trump-Russia investigation. We'd known him only as he'd been described in the press previously as, you know, for lack of a better word, a known Russian gangster and convicted felon. He continued to pop up in very strange ways in Trump's orbit. And one of the things I think our editor Ben Smith does uniquely well is he asks reporters and journalists to zig when others are zagging, right? Like if everyone is swimming in one direction and the sort of, you know, established knowledge or established ideas that one person is X, go out and figure out if that's number one true. And if it's not, explain adequately to the public who this person is. And so we met with him at a bar in Hollywood of all places. I was out there reporting another story and he agreed to meet with us one night and he shared with us, what would turn out to be his statement before a congressional committee. And in it were all of these, for lack of a better word, escapades, these things that he had done on behalf of the U.S. government over a period of a dozen or more years. You know, there had been some mention in the press that he had been a cooperator on behalf of the FBI and intelligence agencies. But with anyone, it was, you know, very critical for us to go out and verify that, to vet it. And so we were able to connect with, I think, a dozen law enforcement sources who had worked with him. And they were able to share with us, yeah, Felix Sater indeed gave us a heads up about an assassination plot against the president. He indeed helped us track down cell phone numbers for key al-Qaeda leaders. He took part in a massively important Russian-based hacking scheme. He led us to a North Korean nuclear scientist who was trying to sell secrets on the black market. So he was this figure who had been seen publicly as this nefarious, you know, creature in Trump's world, when in fact he occupied a separate role as this really incredibly important cooperator for the FBI and the U.S. government. And we were willing to take the risk of telling that story, of challenging the accepted sort of, you know, knowledge of who this dude was. And we still, to this day, get grief about that story from people who simply want him to be what they think he is, the Russian felon gangster.
And when you say it was important to vet him, again, I want to emphasize this aspect of it. You mean vet him against documents that can substantiate or refute what he's saying and with law enforcement sources. Is that fair?
Right. So with documents that actually put to paper his exploits or his work, and then not just with law enforcement who may have heard about, you know, Felix's role at the water cooler, but in fact we needed to get to people who were his handlers, who signed his plea agreement, who signed off on his proffers, the people who were in the room when he, you know, traveled abroad, brought back evidence. These are people who had firsthand knowledge of what he had done. These sources were not folks who, you know, maybe they passed their eyes on stuff. These are in fact people who were there when it happened.
One more antecedent story, which is perhaps the most important for present purposes, but you guys were really the first, as you said at the beginning, Anthony, to focus on, to do a kind of deep dive on Trump Tower Moscow that showed that this project had gone well beyond January of 2016, as Michael Cohen had testified, and that the president had been substantially involved in the months after and had been briefed on it. And furthermore, that it had gone as late as June, even as the president was getting ready for the nominating convention. Jason, talk a little bit about this story, which of course itself is the set of facts that Michael Cohen later pled to having lied about, right?
Yes. So Anthony and I had started to hear in 2017 that this Trump Tower Moscow project, which we didn't know about at the time, and frankly, I don't think anyone really knew about it at the time, had been a very important part of the investigation. We didn't know why, and certainly from the sources that we spoke to, they couldn't exactly figure it out either. But we chased that because it was fascinating because of the individuals that were involved with it. It was Felix Sater, it was Michael Cohen, and we had heard that, you know, that during the course of the campaign that, you know, Trump was also, you know, had a hand in that. Later on, we, you know, all of us in the public and in the media started to see some of these emails being reported from Felix Sater saying we can, you know, get our boy elected if we do this deal in Moscow. But even before that, you know, there was plenty of media revolving around the fact that Trump had wanted to build a tower in Moscow. But Anthony and I, you know, as we started to chase this, we started to shift our attention to this story when we started to gain some ground on it. You know, something that we really, really wanted to focus on in order to tell this story was kind of obtaining all the documents that would lay bare how these negotiations and these discussions took place. And that was a real painstaking effort to pry loose those documents from a variety of sources in order to tell that story. And, you know, we were being told that, you know, this was something that we should focus on and we should stay on because, one, because of the amount of money that was being negotiated and that the Trump organization stood to earn if they were able to get this deal off the ground. And then, you know, I recall very vividly, actually, the point in time when, you know, our sources told us that, you know, that it was a lie that it ended in January 2016, these negotiations, which is what Michael Cohen had testified to, when in fact it, you know, it went on right up before the Republican National Convention. We couldn't figure out at the time, like, why January 2016? Why was that date, you know, so significant? Obviously, right before the Iowa caucuses. So, you know, we were just focused on, one, being able to tell that story. But because of the fact that, you know, many of the people in this universe were, I don't know any other way to say it, but just, you know, we're just flat out liars, and we're telling many different stories, we really felt that it was crucial that if we wanted to tell this story, we needed to, you know, to put people behind the scenes, to, and the only way to do that was through documents. which is essentially what ultimately ended up being, you know, this story that we call the definitive story about the Trump-Moscow negotiations. And months after we published that story, then, you know, Michael Cohen is being charged with lying to Congress over related to his testimony.
But just to clarify again, when you say you were being told, you're talking here about law enforcement sources with knowledge of the investigation, right?
Yes, and we did actually report that. We noted that it was law enforcement sources. You know, we were looking for, you know, let me just note, Ben, that, you know, Anthony and I are it's just the two of us. You know, for 2 years, it's just been two of us reporting on this investigation from New York and L.A. We both traveled to D.C. when need be. I traveled to New York when need be. But it was just the two of us. And we're really looking for, you know, for some guidance. And I think that without really getting into, you know, why sources decided to speak with us, they did. And they helped guide us into areas that we, you know, really wanted to, you know, to focus on.
Okay, so by the time we get to January of 2019, here's this long setup is all an effort to establish this. You guys had developed some relationships with some law enforcement sources who had directed you, guided you, as you say, accurately on, from what my point of view, are at least three major stories. One is the direction that things were going with respect to the Paul Manafort indictment. The second is that Felix Sater has a really interesting history that is very germane to the discussion about the role that he's going to play. And all of that leads up to a focus on Trump Tower Moscow, and specifically the fact that it did not end in January of 2016, a fact that becomes then central in the prosecution of Michael Cohen. And all of this is to one degree or another guided by a group or a set of law enforcement sources who with whom you had developed a relationship. Is that a fair characterization, Anthony?
Yes, that's fair. I mean, I think if you look at it, if you contextualize the sources, the stories that we've done, it's very clear that the sources had been right in the past and had at least some insight into what was happening behind the scenes at the FBI and at the special counsel.
All right. So now let's turn to the story that's at issue here, which I can only imagine the feeling of your stomach turning when the special counsel issues a statement that seems to dispute or does dispute a core element or some significant element of a bombshell story that you guys had reported. So, and the fact that the special counsel did that without saying specifically what elements of the story were, in his judgment, quote, inaccurate, must have made it very difficult to evaluate the complaint or figure out what happened. But before we, you know, dissect what happened here, I'm just interested from each of you, how did you feel when the special counsel issued that statement?
I was confused because the statement just contained, you know, it contained a string of words that I didn't feel at the time went so far as to essentially knock down the entire story. It was truly a feeling of confusion, and at the same time a determination. Because this came on a Friday evening. I happened to have been in Washington, D.C. when I was told by Peter Carr that they would be issuing a statement. But really, it's just a determination to, you know, to find out what happened behind the scenes. So, you know, perhaps at the moment, I was just kind of stunned in receiving the statement, but reading it, you know, and knowing what I was, you know, what Anthony and I had gleaned, you know, from our sources, what we knew about what, you know, went on behind the scenes during Michael Cohen's discussions, you know, I still felt pretty confident. So I just couldn't understand what what this statement meant and why they were releasing it.
Anthony, what was your reaction?
I mean, like Jason, that's not the traditional way that a government body would challenge a story. I mean, if I was covering a local sheriff's department and I had written about some wayward deputies, the sheriff would normally write a very specific letter to the editor to challenge the accuracy of a story. In this case, it seems very broad, and we were unable, through our own interpretation of the records and then subsequent calls to them, to figure out what exactly they were challenging. You'll have to understand, all we care about is getting it right, and if we've gotten it wrong, we really need to amend the public record. We weren't getting any traction there. It seemed like the special counsel was, you know, back channeling with other news organizations, everyone except for us. And I just felt incredibly depressed and sort of beside myself, right? I called an editor and was prepared to resign. It was a really brutal personal moment, and I can share with you that I felt so terribly for my kids because I thought I had embarrassed them. I thought that this was something that was never going to go away and that they would sort of always have to live with this thing that their father had done. And beyond that, I was just deeply hurt because you had folks like Jeffrey Toobin on the television saying that I had committed some grievous sin against journalism. And besides my wife and children, there is nothing in this world I love more than being a journalist. And the idea that I had somehow besmirched the good name of my colleagues and of myself was just I was practically inconsolable for several days. I mean, we were living basically breath to breath, right? The death threats started to roll in. People were calling me and telling me they knew where I live. They knew who my wife was, where my children went to school. But through that sort of very dark 72-hour period, in my head, the rational me was like, wait a second. These sources have gotten this right in the past. We know that we acted in good faith. We took the appropriate steps to run this not past just one or two, but other folks. I kept looking at it going, wait a second. How did we get this wrong? And could it be that this is a matter of interpretation, right? Could it be that there's something here that one side of the special counsel's office is interpreting one way and another is interpreting a different way? And I knew that we weren't going to figure that out very quickly, and that we needed to simply just continue to report. And so that sort of got me through those very dark early moments.
All right. So let's talk about, first of all, I think now we know and by the way, we should pause a moment over the extraordinary nature of the special counsel's report, because there have been a lot of stories that have been reported about what the special counsel knows, has found, has evidence of, that have been quite wrong. For example, there have been stories that Michael Cohen was in fact in Prague, right? There have been stories that, you know, every component of the Steele dossier is checking out, right? There's yeah. there's lots of garbage that has been reported that the special counsel's office has not seen fit to issue a statement challenging. This story was unique in that the special counsel's office not only thought you guys had at some level screwed up, but issued a statement saying that aspects of the report was not accurate. So, Jason, give us a sense of, now that we have the Mueller report, what is it that Bob Mueller, the office institutionally, thinks you guys got wrong? What is it that reads differently if you read this story than if you read the Mueller report?
So, you know, looking at the 3 months, right, leading up to, you know, here we are in January, leading up to, you know, the special counsel's report. And in between that time, you know, Michael Cohen had testified, noting that, you know, he was being told to lie by Trump in the form of code words. It was implicit as opposed to explicit. And when the report comes out, Mueller's report comes out, it says that the evidence to us does not establish that President Trump directed or aided Michael Cohen to lie. That was, I have to be honest, very surprising given what I had read or what we were reading in the Mueller report, you know, preceding those graphs, the many ways in which, you know, Michael Cohen was discussing his testimony with Trump, with the president's personal lawyer, and the fact that, you know, what he had told the special counsel. So my feeling about it is this, is that Michael Cohen was interviewed by the FBI, footnoted in the report. There's a what's known as a 302. Your listeners are obviously very aware of what that is. And the people who were conducting the interview, the investigators believed that, and Michael Cohen certainly believed this, is that he knew how the president, you know, had spoken with him, and he knew what that meant. And I think his testimony backs that up. And the, you know, our sources who had told us about this had really made it clear that Michael Cohen believed he was being directed to lie, and that the discrepancy is, as Ben Smith noted in a post that he did after the report was released, is that, you know, our sources, you know, had interpreted evidence one way, but Mueller's office interpreted another way.
All right. So it's fair. I mean, it's fair to say that the Mueller report's account is that the president seems to have known Michael Cohen intended to lie, didn't do anything about it. His lawyer meets with or talks to Michael Cohen serially in the run-up to the filing of the statement and helps edit the statement. The president informs Michael Cohen that he's happy with the statement, but there does not appear to be a specific conversation in which he explicitly directs Michael Cohen to lie, although Michael Cohen, in his congressional testimony recently, said that there was a conversation in which they talked about maintaining the party line, maintaining the idea that there was no collusion and that it all ended. Whereas you guys had reported that there was a direction, which implies that there's a specific conversation where a specific instruction is given. Is that a fair account of the discrepancy?
I would say it is a fair account. And, you know, let me just also add, Ben, that 2 weeks before the release of the Mueller report, that, you know, Michael Cohen's lawyers prepared this lengthy document that they sent to Congress in an effort to get Cohen's sentence reduced. But within this document, it contains sort of these additional insights into the negotiations and the discussions related to Trump Tower Moscow. And his lawyers write that Cohen believed he was being encouraged, instructed to lie. That can only be interpreted, you know, as a directive. And this is what he had testified to, apparently behind closed doors, to the House Intelligence Committee and the Senate Intelligence Committee recently. And they sent that along. You know, Anthony and I and our colleagues reported on that. Emma Loop, who's one of our colleagues, we reported that story. So, you know, there seemed to be a lot of content coming out that made it clear that Michael Cohen had worked with Trump for a long time, as we know, and he simply just knew how the president spoke. And in his mind, he believed it to be, you know, this is what the president wants me to say, without it having to be spelled out. But obviously, the special counsel, as they noted, the evidence does not establish that, you know. And I think as is made clear, when the Office of the Special Counsel had further asked for clarification from Trump's personal attorney about his negotiations with and discussions with Michael Cohen about Trump Tower Moscow, you know, they declined to provide any more information. So, you know, that's the very lengthy sort of response to your question. That is a, you know, the way that you summed it up was perfect. And it's not lost on either Anthony and I that, you know, our story did say explicit, and, you know, Cohen made it clear in his testimony it was implicit. And but, you know, I think that he understood it, you know, to be explicit.
Okay, so Anthony, let's turn from there to, you know, what the factual basis of the story was at the time you reported it. So we now know what the special counsel's subsequently revealed evidence and interpretation of that evidence showed. We know subsequently what Michael Cohen's later testimony showed. But on January 17th, 2019, you guys had the material that you had. So what was it? You had these sources, these law enforcement sources who had given you good information in the past, including on this very issue. And you had some more stuff which Ben Smith reveals in his editor's note the other day. So describe like what the set of information that you guys were looking at when you wrote this story and what it looked like.
Again, these are individuals that we've worked with in the past. And in this case, they shared with us notes that they took during interviews with Michael Cohen after he's sort of, you know, proffered and brought in. And they felt very, very confident that what he was telling them was that he was instructed or directed by the president to lie to Congress. That was their interpretation of Michael Cohen's interviews. They felt that they had enough to be able to say this definitively. And what we didn't recognize at the time was that we were beginning to see cracks. So the cracks were being formed inside the special counsel's office. I think that's been subsequently reported out by the New York Times, the Post, and others, that there have been enormous disagreements among agents and prosecutors inside the special counsel's office. I think we even thought at the time, this is a smooth running ship. Everyone is rowing in the same direction. When in fact, there were some deep divisions inside that unit. And it's our belief now that, you know, our sources believe this to be true, this idea that Cohen was directed by the president to be a true thing, and that now we're seeing that others in the department, in the special counsel's office, don't believe that they have the evidence, at least, to support that. So we got caught kind of in the middle, where you've got a faction of folks who say, yeah, this is true. He told it to us. We're quite used to listening to witnesses who don't need to be told, hey, go lie for me. It can, in fact, be much more subtle than that, more nuanced than that. Where you've got another set of prosecutors who believe that's not going to fly in court. We can't use it. So there's a real division about what Michael Cohen's testimony, what, you know, his interpretation of this was between members of that team. That's where we kind of got caught up.
So you refer to these notes. What do the notes say? These are notes of the interviews with Cohen. Jason, what do the contemporaneous notes that were taken when the special counsel's office or the FBI was interviewing Cohen reflect that he said?
The story that Ben Smith put out about our reporting on Cohen being directed to lie contains examples of what our sources told us about, you know, what these notes revealed. They're, you know, the notes in as far as what Michael Cohen had told investigators about how he came to believe that he was being directed to lie. And what I do want to note is that Anthony and I believe it's really crucial to go after the actual 302. You know, as we can tell from the Mueller report, there were multiple interviews that Cohen had with the special counsel that obviously were not centered around, you know, the Trump Tower Moscow project. But I don't want to go further than what was already, you know, reported about, you know, what Ben Smith had written as far as what the note said. I think it's really important that we, for a number of different reasons, not just because we want to, you know, lay bare what Michael Cohen said, but, you know, for transparency purposes, we think it's just important to go after, you know, the 302.
Yeah, I think it's important for your listeners to understand exactly what the notes said, or at least part of the notes. And we quoted this, you know, publicly. So in one of them, an agent wrote that, quote, DJT personally asked Cohen to say negotiations ended in January, and White House counsel office knew Cohen would give false testimony to Congress, sanctioned by DJT. Joint lawyer team reviewed letter Cohen sent to SSCI, which is the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, about his testimony about Trump Tower Moscow et al., knowing it contained lies. Source also wrote, quote, Cohen told OSC, which is in this case the Office of Special Counsel, that, quote, he was asked to lie by DJT, DJT Jr., and lawyers. So that says, I mean, you know, we're working with these sources for a long time. They clearly have not led us astray. We're looking at a document or documents that is taken in a moment, a contemporaneous note, and it says to us, you know, Cohen told the special counsel that he was asked to lie by the president. That's essentially what our story said.
And so when you look back on it now, do you say we screwed up? We had all reason in the world to have confidence in the story, but the story is not accurate? Or do you look back on it and say, the story is an accurate reflection of how one group of people associated with the investigation understand what happened, and that faction or that group of people did not prevail in the ultimate preparation of the Mueller report? And by the time you guys wrote the story, the office itself had already kind of rejected that view, which is why the office contested the story. How do you understand it? Do you guys think it's fundamentally there's an error here on your part, or is it partly an error in that you use the word explicit, or is it entirely a reflection of internal disagreement as to how people within that world and that investigation understood the evidence they were collecting?
Yeah, I have to say that as a journalist, you cannot get the gist right. I have to get it all right. I have to get every single syllable correct. And in this case, I did not. That I wrote that it was an explicit instruction, when in fact, the evidence now shows us that it was not explicit, that this was an implied thing. And so I am of the mind that while it does appear that Michael Cohen was in some form instructed, told, directed to lie, that the thesis of the story is sound, the idea that I didn't get the nuance right is really significant, because we don't do gist. And so where we erred, where we failed, was in that particular line. And it's a very important distinction, right? It is a very important thing prosecutorially. It's a very important thing for readers to understand. We got explicit wrong. I take full responsibility for that. All I can do is do better in the future, learn from this and move on. But I'm not going to sit here and sort of sugarcoat this or make it seem like, oh, well, we did okay. Because my job is not to do okay. My job is to be 100% perfect every time. In this case, I was not. I accept that responsibility. Now, as it relates to the sort of internal dealings at the special counsel's office, to sort of, you know, bounce off of what Jason said earlier, we simply don't know. We don't know the timing of when the prosecutors rejected this. We don't know what those internal politics look like. It is our intention, I don't think I'm speaking sort of out of turn here, it's our intention to go get every single shred of paper that came into or out of that office to better understand what was happening, not just with this story, but to understand why the special counsel came to the decisions it came to, what kind of pressures there were either externally on them or internally on them. So it's my intention to understand more, not just about this story, but how they deliberated, what Mr. Mueller thought at the time he knew, and what he would be able to be and his prosecutors would be able to prove in court. So I don't think there's any way I can gloss over this idea that I got the word explicit wrong, and I have to take ownership of that. I won't run from it. But we're not at a place where we can assess what they knew and when they knew it. All we can say is this is what the special counsel is saying right now. They're saying that there was no direction or aid. We're going to sort of see if we can understand. We can look underneath the hood a little bit to figure out where that came from.
Jason, how do you evaluate it?
I mean, I think Anthony summed it up well. I mean, I would, you know, completely agree. I mean, I feel that as Anthony noted, you know, this is, you know, our jobs as journalists is, you know, to get it completely, you know, completely right. But, you know, I do want to also add that, you know, after we had reported this story, we then started to release, you know, the documents about Trump Tower Moscow, all the text messages, emails, contracts that were discussed, exchanged behind the scenes. What was really actually interesting to me is that after we, you know, released this and we put we set it alongside this timeline about what Trump had been saying on the campaign trail as these negotiations and discussions were unfolding. We did this on February 5th, and in the report, in Mueller's report, there's a footnote there that on February 6th, the president's personal attorney responded to the Office of Special Counsel saying that they didn't want to answer any additional questions related to Trump Tower Moscow. So, you know, Ben, what I honestly feel at this point is that, you know, we want to continue our reporting and certainly want to continue our reporting, you know, behind the scenes. I think that, you know, what I'm very interested in is finding out certainly what happened behind the scenes as it relates to the story we reported in January, because I'm just curious, and I think it is newsworthy, about how this statement came to be, who was involved in, you know, the discussion surrounding that statement, but also to kind of get the full picture of what Michael Cohen had told to the FBI and to federal prosecutors, and to really understand what, you know, what it means when where it says in the report that the evidence to us, you know, does not establish that, you know, the president directed or aided Michael Cohen's testimony. But I agree with everything, you know, I mean, Anthony and I are in sync on that.
All right. So we need to wrap up. But Jason, I want to come back to the response to you personally on this, and a bunch of things were written about you in the context of this story that were extremely personal and I thought wildly inappropriate, including by other journalists. And so I'm interested in your, first of all, account of what was said and what was the, you know, what the linkage to this story was, and also just kind of what the impact of that was for you.
Sure. So, you know, it's interesting. On the eve of the, you know, after the story came out on January 17th, late in the evening, I actually, you know, contacted our folks in our PR department and said that I have a feeling that, you know, some people may come after me personally. And then I had said, I just wanted to give you a heads up on that. I was really, you know, surprised at how quickly that happened. It was, you know, started by CNN on air, where, you know, when Anthony was discussing the story on the morning that, you know, after it came out, there was, you know, reporting by Oliver Darcy in CNN, and it really delved into my past. You know, I half a lifetime ago, Ben, you know, I had some personal struggles, which I had been very, very open about. 13 years ago, I had reported a story about Karl Rove being indicted during the unmasking of Valerie Plame's covert identity. It was wrong. He was not indicted. And there was kind of just linking back to that. Again, that was in June of 2006. But it really clearly just became this sort of effort. And it was very apparent to me, this effort to, you know, discredit me and discredit and to erase, you know, all of the work I had done over the years. And it was, you know, how would I say this? It's different. It was different now because the response to it, the way in which people responded to it was, yeah, I was suddenly receiving, you know, these death threats through text messaging on my home phone, on various social media, something I hadn't experienced before. It did leave me rattled. What can I say? You know, I know my past is out there. I'm very aware of that, that, you know, I've been very open about mistakes I've made. I believe and very confident that, you know, the work that I have done since, you know, outweighs the mistakes in the past. But, you know, I'm human, and it still affects me. It hurts. I was actually kind of surprised to see that, you know, the way in which to sort of come after this story that Anthony and I had written was to, you know, lob personal attacks. And perhaps I should not have been, you know, that surprised. And as I noted, you know, I had an inkling and feeling, and I discussed it, that it would likely happen. I was just really stunned that it happened so quickly, you know, but it's certainly the, you know, you stick your neck out there. You have to expect that comes with the territory. This is, you know, it's a cutthroat, you know, being a journalist, it's a cutthroat business. But a lot of it also, you know, when I was able to finally take a step back, it was really, really, much of it was very, you know, for the most part, partisan. And I do think, you know, my work's our work. Anthony, the work that I've done prior to this, and, you know, our work speaks for itself. But I also just want to, you know, lastly note that because of the fact that this story is so partisan, people are so emotionally invested in it, you know, Anthony and I really did want to go out of our way. One, because we think it's just hugely important in telling the story in a climate where the media is under attack, and the, you know, stories that are being written are being labeled as fake news. It's one of the reasons that we feel that it's so crucial to get the receipts, the documents, to see the documents, to publish the documents, and to just put it all out there as another way of standing up what we've reported.
Jason, Anthony, we need to leave it there, but I just want to say I am sitting here in front of a pile of the sort of full corpus of your all's work on this story. And while I agree with you that the individual story in question was flawed and the right standard is 100% accuracy, I do think the body of this work is something that made an enormous contribution, and I want to congratulate you both for it in the aggregate, and to say that to the extent, and there clearly was an error in the particular story, I do think it is a remarkably understandable error given both the human sourcing and also the documentary sourcing that lay behind it. Ooh. So that's just one citizen's opinion, but it is mine. And thank you both for your work and for joining us today.
Thanks. Of
thank
course,
you, Ben.
Be well.
Really appreciate it.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Look, people, we're in tough times. There's no big company that's promoting the Lawfare Podcast. We don't have like a public relations operation that's out there buying space for us on social media like the Internet Research Agency or anything. We only have you guys. So you guys have to be our big building in St. Petersburg that makes people see the Lawfare Podcast. So share us on Facebook like you're a Russian troll. Share us on Twitter. Put us on Pinterest. I think we are underperforming in Pinterest. And for Lord's heaven's sakes, rate us and review us on whatever podcast distribution service you use. Our music is, as ever, performed by Sophia Yan, our audio engineer this week, bringing in Cormier and Leopold from different cities, was Michaela Fogel. The Lawfare podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. We got a lot of merch at thelawfarestore.com. You know you want it. And as always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.